In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred and Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Got a very special Coolest Conversations for you today. I'll be speaking with the Underground Garage's very own Peter Zaremba, weekend disc jockey and host of his monthly Fright Night. He's also the front man in the long-running Flesh Tones. How long-running, you may ask? A full 50 years this year. Been celebrating with shows both here and abroad, and they've also got a 50-year anniversary single coming out September the 4th on Yep Rock Records titled Float Your Showboat. We'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my talk with Peter on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
You know, I've been wondering what you're doing here. What are your intentions? Because it isn't clear. Now, you ain't been arrested. You don't have to hang around. But if you're gonna stay, then why not lose the crowd? We ain't looking for a therapist. Ain't chances are you ain't, but then again you might. Looking so confused, how you wound up in this place. Stare at everybody like they come from outer space. Say it!
The Mighty Manfred, and I am honored beyond description to be speaking with the first amongst the kings of super rock, Peter Zaremba, fellow Underground Garage DJ and host of his monthly Fright Night. It's Count Peter Zaremba. He's front of New York City's Flesh Tones since their inception back in 1976. They are the only band from that CBGB's era never to have gone on hiatus and been continually active a total now of 50 years. In honor of that anniversary, they've been doing some special shows this year. In fact, they also have a special anniversary single, Float Your Showboat, that's due out on Yep Rock Records Friday, September the 4th. Happy anniversary to you, Peter.
What's going on here? I'm hearing Manfred's voice. Manfred, is that you? What's going on?
Yes, it's me. It's me.
Oh man, you know what? I thought I was on the air or something. What's going on?
You are on the airwaves. You are taking over the airwaves, as it should be. As it should be all along.
The satellite beam.
You guys played recently Bowery Ballroom there in New York City, a big 50-year anniversary show. I know you had Mr. Van Zandt, Stevie Van Zandt introduced you guys. You had buddies like Peter Buck, Mike Mills, Steve Wynn, Andy Chernoff, those guys all there. What about a founding member? Was it Jan Marek Pakulski? But he was there too, right?
Yeah, we did a special Time Machine IRS Years mini set with founding member Marek Pakulski. It was like he never left. You know?
Really? Wow, yeah. That's great. Well, tell me about the event in general. This was how long did it take to assemble everything? How'd you feel about the show? It's a Bowery Ballroom, right?
Yeah. You know what? I'm still recovering from it. And our old friend, the junior, he got the Junior Achievement Award that night. We did bestow a bunch of awards, We inducted new inductees into the Fleshtones Hall of Fame. And one of them did go to Todd Lance Abramson, who we met when he was 12 years old. He was the one who said, guys, go for the ballroom. Because at first we were thinking, okay, we want to do this on the Bowery where we first played publicly. And it was CBGB's 50 years ago. CBGB's is, of course, gone. So we're thinking Bowery Electric, which is about less than half the size.
Yeah.
And he said, go big. And I have to say that later on, those words, that thought was echoed by Mr. Van Zandt himself, who said, let's go big. Let's blow this thing up. Let's blow it up, Zaremba.
So you had a blast, an atomic blast took place at the Bowery Ballroom.
It did. Like I said, I'm still recovering from it. That night was just like just keeping this thing from careening off the cliff was so hard, because we had so many guests, you know, the ones you mentioned. Yeah, and Steve Wynn sang one of our songs. I sang one of Jeff Conley's songs, you know.
How Do I Know?
How Do You Know?
Yeah.
Which was very the right song to sing. And definitely from the heart, having known him from the mid-70s.
Let me ask you real quick about we're talking about Jeff Conley, the Mono Man, Frontman and Liars, and DMZ. When was the first time you guys met each other or played with each other?
Okay, first time I saw DMZ play was also the first time I saw the Real Kids play. Miriam Lynn, who was still, I think, in the Cramps at that point, and I went up there as talent scouts for Marty Thau. That was my first time in Boston. We went down into the Rat basement, the Rat Skeller, on Kenmore Square. And the Battle of Bands it was being broadcast over BCN. It was amazing. It was like, I couldn't tell which kids were dancing and which ones were fighting or both. And the band, I mean, it was just mind blowing. And the next day we went over and visited Jeff at his apartment that overlooked famous Buzzy's Roast Beef and the jail yard of the Suffolk prison. And, He was pulling out like obscure 45s and stuff, and he had some kind words to say. Probably the last kind words he ever did say to me. But you know, he had high standards. What can I say? One thing I have to say is that, and I say it whenever I play a Liars record on the station, is that he doesn't get the credit that he really deserves for helping us, you know, focus. You know, what became this whole garage rock revival movement, whatever you want to call it. You know, he was just so pure, and he wasn't trying to take it back to 1966, but he was just trying to capture the essence, you know, and he would play us stuff and say, you know, listen to that drum fill. It's so stupid. It's great. You know? And he was, you know, always capturing that. So anyhow, one of the Voidoids, our good friend, Ivan Julian, sang a song with us. It was great. And at the end, everyone came on stage and sang or joined us for our new song, Float Your Showboat, and stayed there I can't tell how it sounded, but our first 45 from 1978, American Beat. We did After that, you know, just keeping the whole thing going. And everyone said it was pretty seamless. You know, there wasn't too many people looking around the stage tuning up or anything. You know, people just hit the stage hot and the songs kept coming.
Yeah. You know, in that moment, you're doing the show, of course, you have to be focused. But over the course of the evening, post show or leading up to the show, were there any ghosts floating about in your mind? People that you knew that weren't there to attend, that couldn't attend.
You were there.
What's that?
You were
Well, no, but I'm thinking more.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, of course, you know, Jeff, Conley and everybody. And but you know what? To tell you the truth, it was more the liveness of the event and the fact that the people that were there
yeah.
performing happily and getting into it overrode all that. You know what I'm saying? Although yeah. it did this feeling of maybe a bookend, you know?
Yeah.
Not necessarily an epilogue, but maybe like a bookend to an era or something. You know what I mean? Although it was so live, you know? It didn't seem as nostalgic. You know, we were doing Stay With Me by the Dictators, you know, and Andy yeah. was singing it. And it everything was on. You know what I mean? It was on. It was on for the for now. It was very now that evening, you know. So and I didn't have time to get too reflective, or you know what I'm saying. It was very live, and the
flesh tones are now, baby. You know,
it's
never stopped being now, and you assembled. You know, you assembled this wide variety of friends to bring that celebration home after 50 years. I mean, that's so awesome.
You know, yeah, it was like, you know, Peter Buck, you know, was and Mike Mills were like, okay, they had a few songs they were going to play, but then he's going, I'll play on, you know, as it was happening, he's going like, oh, I'm going to play on this one too, and you know, and Mike did the same thing, played board, and the one thing I passed up the opportunity was, you know, Mike Stipe was up in the balcony, and
yeah.
I chatted with him a little bit, and it didn't occur to me to say. Do you feel like singing anything? And I don't know. At first I was thinking, well, he wants to be incognito. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Incognito.
Well, you know, I guess one of those things that he has to have it on himself too, to know that he could have just walked up there. What were you going to do? Pick him off the stage? You would have put your arm around him and you would have said, lean into the mic.
Yeah. I do think. I think after it was said and done, I said, you know, he was probably waiting to be asked.
Oh, well, I want to take, let's take a moment. Let's
take a moment.
Hey, I want us to run down, you to run down the beginnings of the band for us. Cause that's just a great story that needs to be repeated. Keith Strang and Merrick, they got this house and somehow their instruments in the basement. What's the story here? Remind us.
Okay. It's an oft told tale. Keith and I had been trying to put together bands for years. Okay. All through the early 70s, quite unsuccessful. You know, Keith was in a few practice things with Ricky Bird back then.
Oh,
when
wow.
Keith was drumming. He was on the scene.
Did I hear that right? You said Keith was drumming.
Yeah, Keith started as a drummer, and he was drumming, you know, with various people. He, and like I said, he did some, you know, jam sessions, whatever you want to call them, garage jamming with, you know, like people like Ricky Bird, and, you know, people in the neighborhood and whatnot. But we were at a loss, really, how to really do it, you know? And Keith and I went to see the Ramones, finally. And like many other people, the light finally came on. Oh, the way you do it is you just do it. Now, in their basement, they had a house rented in Whitestone, a very nice residential part of Queens. And in the basement was some abandoned, really junky. At that point, people weren't into collecting Japanese copies and stuff. There was like a teardrop bass. That had like a 2.5-inch action. and Marek started playing that. Keith, there was a guitar with like, again, it had like 4 pickups and 25 different switches, most of which didn't do anything. He put strings on that. And he would switch off from drumming and playing guitar and drumming and playing guitar. I picked up a harmonica and started singing. And the band was born. And the first thing we were doing was, you know, we played big house parties. Keith would mix up the Blue Whale in a garbage can. So we'd have like 40 gallons of Blue Whale. And we'd play.
What are the ingredients in a Blue Whale?
Mostly, was it really cheap vodka, although you could use good vodka, that would be better. Not too much blue curacao, make it blue and give it that orangey flavor.
Yeah.
And what they used to sell was pink lemonade concentrate. So you dump maybe two or three of those concentrates, you know, those cans.
Cans. Yeah.
They were made out of cardboard or something. They were weird cans. So you dump three of those in there and maybe, I don't know how many bottles of vodka, tons of ice. And
we're talking about a good trash can sized punch bowl here.
Trash can full. And then, you know, it goes down extremely easy. And everyone would get, you know, people would just get into it, you know. And we're, you know, blasting records. At that point, you know, the Dictators album was out, you know, rock and roll stuff like that. Ramones record, I don't even think it'd come out yet. You know, all sorts of stuff. And the Fleshtones, you know, after we did that, Keith to this day can recite the phone number by heart of CBGB's. Ask him the next time you see him. He'll reel it right off from calling Hilly Crystal so many times. You know, so we finally did an audition. I think it was May 17th, 1976. We passed the audition, which meant we could audition again, which is a way, you know, that you could play and they wouldn't have to pay you. So we did that. And then we started playing there in Max's and all that stuff, and have been doing it ever since.
So you and Keith already knew each other from, you both were in the same neighborhood. You grew up in the same neighborhood.
Really? He was up in Whitestone and I was in a place called Murray Hill, which is a part of Flushing, but we both Flushing High, as did Andy Chernoff of the Dictators and a few other people. And I was the president of two clubs, official high school clubs. One was the Lost in Space Club, which was dedicated to watching the TV show and talking about it. And the other one was the Aleister Crowley Aleister Crowley Trail Club. And Keith was members of both of those, and that's how we met. I was president, of course. I was always the leader. Like yourself, Manfred.
Okay. I was hearing this some of an interview that you did, and the guy, the interviewer, was asking you if Lenny K's Nuggets compilation was a big influence on you, and you said no. I mean, that you didn't hear it until the 80s and that you already had his 45s. So go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, what is your, you're familiar with these great rock and roll tunes. Well, what's the story on kind of your rock and roll journey? Like, did you see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan? Was that a thing? I mean, you mentioned the Ramones being sort of this epiphany, but what were you doing? What were you doing in the 60s when you were a kid? What were you listening to? How did you get to rock and roll?
Okay. The whole family went over to Uncle Charlie and Aunt Regina's apartment in Woodside, Queens, and watched the first Ed Sullivan appearance of the Beatles on. They had a better TV than us, so we all went over there to watch it with Aunt Regina and Uncle Charlie and my parents, my big sister. Of course, they were very unimpressed with all that. You know,
what about your big sister? What did she think?
Oh, she was a Beatlemaniac. her and her best friend Joan. Okay, I remember very early on. This was still in 1963, in the fall of 63.
Yeah,
her and her friend Joan sitting at our kitchen table, hand making Beatles buttons, badges as they call them. The Beatles would call them buttons. You know, hand them and taping them to buttons, and hand making Beatles buttons because Beatle merchandise did not exist in this country as of yet. And that was like in the fall of 63. Then finally she came rushing into my bedroom one day and said, "Buddy," that's my family name, "Buddy, quick, listen to the radio. It's the Beatles." And we turned on the radio and it was the Beatles. And it might've been "Please, Please Me," you know? My first thought was that they were black. Totally. because it didn't sound like a white group at all.
Yeah.
It was so raw, you know, it sounded like, and also it sounded kind of primitive to me, you know, very electric. And oddly enough, not more than a week later, she rushed into my room and said, quick, turn on the radio. It's the Dave Clark Five. And I think that was glad all over.
And how much older? How much older than you is your sister? I mean, how close?
2 years.
2 years. So, okay, so it's pretty close then.
Yeah, but she was starting. She was already like a very developed preteen at that point. You know.
Yeah.
You know, she was about. I think she was just about to turn 13 and be a teenager, and of course, she went to see the Beatles. I think at Carnegie Hall, and Forest Hills. And then she finally invited me to see go see the Beatles with her at Shea Stadium, which I turned down because I hated Shea Stadium. And I couldn't understand how you could see a group play in a baseball field. I just figured that was like ridiculous. I regret that now, but I understand my logic at the time.
Right. Did when you were growing up, did your parents make either of you or your sister take like music lessons? Was there...
No. I was a combination of too lazy and too afraid. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
By the time I was 11 and 12 and listening to, you know, Beatlemania and British Invasion, I was dying to play guitar, but I figured it was too late for me to learn. And it went on like that for years and years. Finally, in the 80s, my friend Brian, you know, he was having dinner at our house and he said, here, pick up this guitar. I'll show you how to play it in 5 minutes. And he did. You know, he showed me the rudimentary of doing the bar chords.
Yeah.
And how that makes sense. And it finally clicked in my head. It wasn't, you know, it seemed like, you know, to me, playing guitar was all these notes and scales and this and that. And basically all I wanted to do was know how to play You Really Got Me. And he says, oh, you do it this way. And he showed me in 5 minutes. It totally demystified the whole thing.
I remember seeing you guys years ago and you would get like a keyboard kind of messing around on the yeah. keyboard. Was it guitar first or the keyboard second?
Keyboard was first. And I acquired a keyboard to play four notes. We used to do a version of... The Strange Loves Carolyn.
Yeah.
And I played the solo, the four note solo, you know, and that would be the only thing I'd play. So that started me, you know, I got a Farfisa, which you could buy for like $25 then. No one wanted them. And that started me off playing keyboards. I do to this day remain the world's worst recorded keyboard player. I think I add color, you know.
Yeah, certainly. A whole lot of color and vibrancy, vibrant colors.
I paint in a palette of vibrant colors. Thank you.
Here you are, the Beatles and the Dave Clark Five, and you're listening to great stuff on the radio.
Amazing.
And you're there in high school, you meet Keith, and well, when did you guys graduate high school? Was that in 76 too, or when did you graduate? 75?
74-ish.
74.
73, 74. Then I was in art school, and when I got to art school, it was cheap enough then. Me and my friends got a loft on Broadway, of all places. Broadway in between 18th and 17th streets, around the corner from Andy Warhol's new factory, and also less than a block away from Max's Kansas City. So, and we were able to do that. And so, you know, once we started going to see bands, it was really easy, you know, and it was amazing. Now, going back to Lenny the K.
Yeah.
Although I was aware of the Nuggets thing. And again, my friend Brian, I was walking with him somewhere and he said, well, I just went back to my parents' house and I dug up all these 45s, you know, of mine. And he's showing them to me. And it was like, you know, Talk Talk and Little Girl and Dirty Water and all that stuff. And it was all stuff that, you know, I knew from the radio and liked, you know. Now, what did strike me was where I was working, we listened to oldies music. And every once in a while, they would play some Eddie Cochran and Ritchie Valens. So I decided I needed go out and buy some Eddie Cochran, you know. And that it wasn't a rockabilly thing. What got me with Eddie Cochran was when I think he kind of invented a new type of music, like with, you know, Summertime Blues and Come On Everybody. You know, that stuff wasn't really rockabilly anymore, you know. And so I bought a compilation that had just come out. And that became a huge influence on me. I even got my mother to buy me a leather bomber jacket, just like Eddie's, you know. And I know the liner notes were great. I read the liner notes. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I realized that that record was put together by Lenny.
You know, okay.
That was Lenny Kaye's Eddie Cochran compilation.
Relation.
Huge influence on me, and shared that, you know, pre-flesh tone bands, we covered songs from there, like Genie, 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 and My Way, and a few of the other songs, you know. Nervous Breakdown.
Oh, yeah. All this great. There it is. You're still in touch with Keith, and you're going to art school, and that's when it's like, hey, we've seen the Ramones. What's holding us back? There are instruments in the house, and then you start doing it. And then you start these parties, and then what's the transition?
But we could play at the parties.
But what gets you from doing the parties into like wanting to you want to play clubs, you want to do more with it
immediately?
You know, wow.
It's fulfilling a childhood desire, right? We immediately wanted to do that. You know, the parties were great. They were insane. I can't describe half of what went on, but I would say good, clean fun mostly. Although once, you know, it was my turn to answer the door when the police came. It was like the third time that night. And finally the police, they said, okay, Zeremba, you got to answer the door. So they just kind of brushed me aside and came into the house. And as, one policeman stepped over not unconscious, but very drunk girl. As he stepped over, he said, if that was my daughter, I'd shoot her. That was New York cop humor. They didn't
bother. Oh, of course, that was humor. Excuse me, I didn't catch that for a moment.
Well, if you've seen Martin Scorsese movies, you get it. But the fact is, they didn't arrest us. They didn't bust us. They didn't, they told us to turn it down, and we did. Whatever. But anyhow, playing in the party, we figured, hey, let's do that. And then it's like, hey, we see a lot of bands, we're playing as good as them. We know 8 songs. Let's go.
What were those 8 songs?
You know what? One of them, I think, was Nervous Breakdown. Another one was Little Girl. And then the rest was all originals, because we didn't think we were good enough to play covers. The one was called Starfish in the Sea. One was called Johnny's Got a Girlfriend. What was the other one? Sidetracked. I don't know. We don't play these songs anymore.
Well, why not? You got to revisit those. I want to hear the party years. The party years. Right. You got to dig up those up, you know?
That might be a good idea, Manfred, because we already did the Time Machine IRS Years mini set. So maybe we'll do a pre Red Star.
Red Star. So you mentioned Marty Tao, and that's his label. And you and Miriam kind of went up to Boston to check out to Talent Scout. So the band's first single, American Beat, is on Red Star. You said it came out. I thought it came out in 1979. You said it was 1978.
I think it was 78, but you could be right. 79.
Well, I could, you know. Right. And then you wound up re-recording that later on, like in 84. There's the Tom Hanks Beach Bachelor Party movie. Yeah. And what I like about that version is that, you name checks all these rock and roll artists, groups, blues, R&B artists. It's almost like an underground garage playlist as you're yelling out these.
You know what? Okay. That was a vamp, obviously.
Yeah.
I scribbled notes, but we did two takes of that. And Richard Goddard, one of our heroes from, a Niall Strange of the Strangeloves, was producing that. And he decided one take was better than the other, and we agreed. A little bit later, we were doing the Cutting Edge show that I was hosting, and we were shooting the Ramones because we were doing a New York show. And Joey Ramone had never spoken a word to me, ever. In fact, none of the Ramones had ever spoken a word to me. But while we're doing, everyone's fooling around, setting up the cameras and this and that, Joey comes up to me and says, "Zaremba." So all of a sudden, I was shocked he knew my name. And he goes, "American Beat. You mention all these great bands. You mention all these American bands. You don't mention us. Why not?" And my heart sunk, you know. And I said, "You know what? There were two takes. One I did mention you, and I don't even remember which one they used. I guess they used the one where I didn't. And that was a huge omission. Because the Ramones, without the Ramones, we wouldn't have existed.
Right.
In fact, without the Ramones, a lot of bands wouldn't exist, you know, like that whole bunch of Brit punks, right? Not, you know, they were all at the Roundhouse and they saw the Ramones, and the next day, they all had the marching orders. They all knew what to do, and there's nothing wrong with that. That we did that too. Anyway, I felt bad about that, you know, and I tried to explain, but it didn't do any good, you know. So Manfred, this is an important lesson, and I think you've learned this a long time ago, and I've learned it, and I try to impart this to people. What you record lasts forever. You know, it's recorded.
You know? That's it, right? And then that's it's there for better. One hopes, but I bet the other lesson here is don't list out people's names. Somebody's going to get their feelings hurt.
Right. Don't mention anyone. You know.
No. Well, thinking about the Flesh Tones, your music, and American Beat. When you guys just first part playing rock and roll stuff, was there a consciousness of that? Was the sense of American beats? That's always been the center of your sound, right? Was that, it wasn't like, oh, hey, let's be more of a this is sounding too typical, too rock and roll. Let's sound more arty. Did you guys start playing? What was the thing music wise? Yeah. Like the beat, American beat. What is it?
You know, okay, we were a little bit arty in the beginning, but we were also like, you know, we were going to discos because we felt, you know, first of all, we enjoyed them. And the ones that we went to played what really was the natural evolution of R&B and soul. You know, that's what that was going on then. And, you know, we were huge Stones fans. We were huge Beatle fans. The Kinks, we worshiped the Kinks and the Yardbirds and all that stuff. But all of those guys were trying their best to sound American. You know, I mean, they couldn't because they were English, but that's what they were trying to do, you know? And after a while, you know, we were realizing, hey, you know, they were all, you know, our first EP we dedicated to Larry Williams, you know? You know, because we were that's what we were trying to get at. You know, we were trying to get at, you know, Larry Williams or the Strangeloves or, you know, anyway, you know, Richie Valens, Eddie Cochran, you know, all of this great stuff, you know, and it was all the stuff the British invaders were listening to anyway, you know, so it was the American beat. And we weren't okay, we're going to make everything sound like it's the spring of 1966, you know, we kind of mixed what we liked, you know, everything together, you know, and a lot of people didn't like that, you know. The Artie people in New York condemned us as being a twist band.
Being a what? A twist band?
Yeah, twist band. That was a put down.
Yeah.
And you know what?
Well, gosh, I mean, I I mean, I understand that being supposed to be a put down, but I would wear that as a badge of honor saying, yes, yeah, if you can twist to it, it's eternal.
Right. It means, quite frankly, it means that you're getting through to people. You're making them move.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, you know, we would, you and I would, and our listeners and everything, we'd say, hey, that's good. You know, be Joey D and the Starlighters. Okay, another band we admired a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, let's twist, you know, let's do it. So, yeah, you know, the stuff from New Orleans, whatever, you know, this sort of early kind of soul rock and roll from the South. But, you know, Joe Simon, you know. The first real disco hit, Get Down, Get Down. You know that. You're from down there. This stuff is great, you know, and it all has that spirit. It all makes you want to dance, you know. We were never shoegazers, you know.
Thank goodness.
Right. Neither, you know, you guys aren't, you know. And
well, you know, I'll go ahead and tell you real quick my story. The first time I saw you guys, I was up in, this is like probably 80, 85. And then it was in it's in Athens, Georgia, and you guys would go up, you would play, come down to Athens, and you play a couple of nights at these different clubs and sell them out each time. And this particular club was the Uptown Lounge.
Oh, yeah, the Uptown, yes.
And we were, I worked at the student radio station there, the WOG 90.5 FM, and in that their rotation, they had the Speed Connection, the live album, and... this great guy, Greg Germani, had written in the margin of the album there that more kicks than a kung fu convention. I saw that and I said, well, this, and then heard the Kingsman like medley. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then I went down to the show and, you know, I was just, it was way, everything's way over the top. There's, I guess maybe this is an 87, because it seems like Flesh Tones versus Reality had come out, so maybe it's 87 instead. But there you are. There's the Return of the Leather Kings, a song, and you could pull people up from the audience, and these people are on stage bowing down to Bill Millhiser there on the drums. And then at one point, you're on one side of the club up on some tables and key strings on the other side, and there's this call and response going back and forth across the room, and then you guys take the audience out into the street, and there's this chanting going on, and then it's back into the club, and it's just phenomenal. It blows my mind. And there's a guy, David Giles, who later played in the Woggles, but he ran one of the record stores in town, Ruthless Records. And I was like, my God, Davey, this is the most awesome thing I've ever seen in my life. And he's like, yeah, they used to be a little bit better, you know, but doing that whole record store thing, right? And I was like, my God, if it was better than this, my head would have exploded. So, you know, if this is them tampered down, then life is really fun. Life is really great.
Now, didn't we hang out and go to, I always, in my brain, it's that we went to Wuxtree Records together or something, or maybe we went to Ruthless Records, but, and then you were, I believe you played me your Xantar tapes or something like that. When did that happen?
Wow, I don't know. I remember the first time I got on stage with you. That was in Atlanta at the the Point was the name of the club, and yeah, I would never have gotten on stage to sing this song, but I was so irritated that this other guy that was pulled up on stage. It was, you're playing with the cocaine song, with the Clapton cocaine thing.
Yeah, J.J. Cale's Cocaine. Great song.
Right, J.J. Cale. So, and it was just like, oh man, this is obviously, it's so easy, dummy, to the whoever, you know, was, and so I had to just take that over because I could not, we had to move the show along, and this guy was holding it up.
He was. he was
standing in the way of greatness, and I was not going to allow that.
Well, I'm glad you rose to the occasion. Yes, I remember it very well, and it was fun. And we didn't even know the song. We played it off the cuff, but it's easy.
Well, that's what I figured, right? Yeah,
riff, you know, a great riff.
early on there, so you've got this, you do the next thing, you know, for the parties to the clubs, and then there's the labels, you know, there's Marty Tao, the Red Star, and then you get on to IRS, and then that label was really coming into its thing then, right? Your label mates with REM and the Cramps. Yep. You later share a rehearsal, or at some point you shared a rehearsal space with them. You wound up appearing on American Bandstand. You mentioned hosting Cutting Edge, which, you know, predated that 120 minutes on MTV. Those must have been really heady times during that era. And then that ended, right? You're not on IRS. And you guys, you keep going. Was there ever a moment where you're like, oh, we had our run, now we're done? Or how did you deal with that moment?
No, you know, it wasn't like, hey, we had our run, now we're done. It was more like, you know, okay, what are we going to do now? Now we got to keep going. And we always managed to find another label, you know. We found the 688, you know.
Oh, yeah, Atlanta. Again, that's the Atlanta thing. There was a club in Atlanta that had a label for a short while.
Very short while, very ephemeral. And then we were on Ichiban Records for a while. They were down there somewhere. Where was Ichiban located?
That was Atlanta as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Atlanta area.
So Georgia looms big in our story. I mean, we were, you know, it was a struggle, but on the other hand, we kept playing, you know, and we were, you know, we could play anywhere and have fun and, you know, put together tours, play in France a lot, play in Spain a lot, play in Italy a lot, Scandinavia. Eventually a big fan of ours, Dave Faulkner of the Hoodoo Gurus, got us on their label in, oddly enough, in Australia, Trafalgar.
Was that the Power Stance album, that era?
You've done your work, I can tell you.
I just pulled out of my butt.
Okay.
No, it's like, I think that's when that must have been.
And I think, no, okay, we did Power Stance, and then maybe we did, that got us into Ichiban, the Ichiban years.
Yeah.
And then we had no label, and my sister lent us $1,000 so that we could go to a friend's basement studio and record a bunch of covers and put out our own record just to keep going. That was called the Flesh Tones Favorites.
Did that have the drum head? Okay.
It's the pro from the famous Frothy, A Perfect Whiskey Sour Every Time. A prop that you might recall as a child, maybe in your aunts and uncles, way in the back of the liquor cabinet, collecting dust, a little white plastic bottle. It was propylene glycol. And you put a few drops in your shaker and put a head on your whiskey sours and Mai Tais and stuff. But the pro was, you know, the guy. Anyway, I don't know, that went on. Eventually we played a frat party. We were hired by a fraternity at Gettysburg College. And it was total Animal House scene. Totally, with the, you know, the police at the door, don't let the police in, we're playing live, so they don't want the police in, so the police come in through the windows in the living room right behind us as we're playing. Sometime in the course of that night, we went upstairs to talk with the two frat brothers who hired us, Tor and Glenn, and Glenn looked at me and said, you know, he might have said when we grow up, but I think he said when we graduate. When we graduate, we want to start a label so we can sign you guys and bands like you. Sure enough, they eventually founded Yep Rock Records. Again, in the South. You
know, hey, it's the circle of life.
Yeah. And we've been on Yep Rock for what? 25 years or something.
And the new single that's on Yep Rock as well, when it comes out on the 4th.
It'll come out on the 4th, although I guess you can pre-order now. And the funny thing about being on Yep Rock is more and more, all of the people that we admired and listened to or winding up on the Up Rock. So all of a sudden, oh yeah, I'm label mates with Robin Hitchcock.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I'm label mates with Lenny Kaye. You know, it's like crazy. So all great.
All great. And is there any place, let's think, there's seven continents, Asia, yeah. Africa, North America, South America, Antarctica, Europe, Australia, basically. Assuming that you haven't rocked with the Penguins, which continents have you not played on?
We've never played officially in South America. We've played in Latin America, of course. We've played in Mexico many times. But we've never played, you know, in Brazil or anywhere in, you know, South America. We've played in the Caribbean a few times. That was great. We've played in Asia. We've played
right, India and China, right?
But never Japan. And I don't think we ever will, but that's okay. We've never played Africa, although there were times when that was sort of possible, but we'll see. We were up for once for playing a big festival in Morocco, but by way of being, you know, connected through France.
Right.
And we were up for that, but that festival got canceled by the King of Morocco because he felt the students did poorly in their end of the year exams. And so he said, this is not going to be a rock and roll festival. A king, that's the kind of king that can do that.
You know, wow.
He didn't know what he was missing. We're working on the Prince of Monaco, though, because somehow we might wind up doing that Music Day thing, you know, Fête de...
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, it's a French holiday, Fête de la Musique, Music Day. It's in May.
Okay. May,
yeah, and people have lots of bands and stuff, and we might do that someday. We'll see.
Yeah. So, well, is there... I forgot to mention that, you know, you guys have, there's a book about you, Sweat, The Story of the Flesh Tone. There's also the documentary, Pardon Us for Living, but the Graveyard is Full. Is there anything you haven't done in the first 50 years that is now a priority? Like outside of just wanting to play and record more music and travel the world, is there a specific thing like we've never played in Africa or we've never... You know, we've never played in Japan, or is there something?
Well,
that...
we never have played in Japan. But I, at this point, I don't find that'll ever happen. But, you know what? I think we keep getting better at making records. You know, and we keep enjoying it more.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like I always said. I wish that at one point. We make one record half as good as How Do You Know by the Liars or as good as ABBA by the Paragons. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, make that perfect record. All these perfect records are quite flawed, you know? Keep on dancing.
Yes, well.
Keep on dancing by the Gentries. You know what I mean?
I learned about that I didn't realize is that it's the... The song ended, you know, when the song ends and yeah. The engineer was like, oh, that's too short. It needs to be longer. And they kind of looked at each other in the studio and was like, that's all we got. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. And he just tacked on the beginning of the song at the end. So he says, pause. And then it literally is just the beginning of the song playing over again.
Yeah. You see, that's why ever since I have been invited into the stable of Little Stevens Underground, I am still learning, even at this age. And I learned things like that.
We're all students.
I love it.
See, we're talking about the perfect record. Let's talk about this, yeah. The 50th anniversary single. Okay, yeah. Coming out on Yep Rock September the 4th. You mentioned Yep Rock being on your, you guys being on the label since back into the early 2000s. The A side is Float Your Showboat. And that was playing before we started chatting. So, is that a Zaremba composition? Who wrote Float Your Showboat?
Okay. Keith sent me some music that he recorded over in Stockholm, where he does live.
Right.
And, he said, you know, he said, maybe we can do something with this. And I listened, I said, hell yeah, we're going to do something with this. Because this, what he came up with totally fit an idea that I had, you know, kind of knocking around in my head for a couple of years now, actually. But I didn't quite have any music, you know?
Right.
And so we kind of chopped that up and put it together. And it and kind of winds up being more like the sort of thing we were doing when we were doing like Hexbreaker and
yeah, Rome. I was thinking Flesh Tones versus Reality era in there too, but
yeah, you know, like kind of dance oriented. Dare I say almost rap, almost if we had something to rap about. But you know, it's a bit chanted and easy, you know, has a chorus that's easy to sing and seems like a danceable thing. So that's how that, you know, and I enjoy that a lot because for a while it was like, you know, Keith would come with a bunch of songs, I'd come with a bunch of songs, and it's fun when we put them together, you know.
In fact, I was going to ask if how the songwriting process has changed over the years, because it seemed, you know, more often than not early on, there's string zaremba, zaremba string compositions. And then as time goes on, it seems like there's more, you know, a song that's credited specifically to you. I mean, they all sound like Flesh Tone songs, but there's ones that are credited to you, accredited to Keith, or they're credited to Ken Fox, the bass player. And then, you guys are working on another album, I mean, how does that process take place?
Recently, like maybe the past two albums or so, we've gotten much more back into Keith coming with a bunch of music and sitting around his kitchen table, because he still has a kitchen table in Williamsburg. And we sit around the kitchen table and, you know, shoehorn these things into songs. And it's a lot of fun, you know. I'm glad that we've gotten back to doing that a lot, you know, which is how we started. So, you know, we're back to that. You know, the songs are, we're having more fun in the studio, you know.
What's your showboat? Where did you record that? Was that with Mike Giblin, or where did you do it?
It was Mike Giblin of the Split Squad. And so we recorded a lot of it in Dillsburg, Pennsylvania, which is on the Gettysburg Pike between Gettysburg and Harrisburg, southern Pennsylvania. And then a little bit we also did, he has a new studio in Ellensville in the Catskills.
Oh, wow.
So we did some there. And, you know, we also came across unfinished songs from our session for our Solid Gold Sound album, which I guess was around 2000, 2001. I thought that these tapes were lost. And by moving, I discovered that I had the reel-to-reels all along. And there's three unfinished songs on that. So over the course of the year, we finished our version of Wawa Tusi, the Orlan song.
Yeah.
Kind of going back to almost an Eddie Cochran-ish, but I don't know, street corner vocal group, Eddie Cochran, acoustic, whatever. We finished that, and everyone sent in their parts from wherever, like Keith from Stockholm.
Right.
I did most of the work at home. And then down to having Bill Millhiser do his backing vocals at the Shiva Cottages in Goa.
Where?
In Goa, in Morjim, Goa, in India. So,
well, he's over there with a Maharishi or something.
No, we were there touring India, and our last shows were in Goa. So when we were staying at the Shiva Cottages. But it was just kind of a backpacking kind of, you know, resort, little cottages on the beach. And it was absolutely lovely. So I thought it was
mentioning these several songs, when can we expect a new full length?
Well, okay.
2024 is getting late, more songs about werewolves. That's the last album. When's the new one?
Sometime in 26, unfortunately.
27 or the later this year? I mean, we're almost done with 2026. You mean 2027?
These years keep flying by. 27.
Yeah.
You know? Maybe we recorded at sea together. You can join us. I was going to ask you about your magnificent, but anyway, you're asking.
We're going to be on the boat together next year.
I know that.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying we'll get magnificent together next year
when we say. Okay. We'll definitely have an album, you know, coming in 27. Plus, there's going to be the reissues of the new expanded Solid Gold sound. For all of those who missed that album the first time around, which is most of the public.
Well, that's another wonderful thing about the Fleshtones is they always always extend that hand for a second chance. You want a second chance.
Yes, yes, they're right. The postman always rings twice or whatever. So that album, that's going to be re-released on Yep Rock, and it's going to have a few extra tracks.
Is what I heard.
Huh?
Three tracks. You were telling us about the Wawatosi. Well, what were the other two?
Okay. There was a version of Wawatosi that's finished. There was we finished a version of a Keith song called Drink, Drank, Drunk.
That's great. Sounds great.
But you know what? So far remaining unfinished is a version of The Students Every Day of the Week, which is one of my favorite songs, you know.
Right, the doo-wop thing there.
Oh, yeah. We do it again more
Cockney.
More Cockney. Cockney meets a street corner vocal group, you know, which is a nice thing. Did I tell you that my cousin was in Randy and the Rainbows? You know.
Oh, so I didn't. Wow. Wow.
That was actually my cousin married Sal, one of the singers and one of the Rainbows. Yeah. So he became part of the family and was my cousin in those days.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of rock and roll way back then.
So you've already done shows, anniversary shows in Europe, or are those coming up?
Well, we did our big French, 50th anniversary show with all our French band friends. That was very good. Two nights, actually. It was great. And beautiful Saint-Gilles-de-Croix-de-Vie on the Atlantic coast. Lovely town. If you like sardines. You like sardines? Grilled sardines.
It depends on what time of the night is and whether I'm enjoying drinks or not. But yes, I can eat sardines.
I'm saying grilled sardines, not the ones out of the... Fresh sardines, right out of the water.
Of course.
Yeah. Grilled on wood. They're delicious. Anyway, that's a French capital for sardines. We're going to go back to Europe. We're going to do a little Scandinavian thing with our French, our Scandovanian friends, a big show in Stockholm, you know, with guys from the Nomads and the Maharajas and the Crimson Shadows and all the Maggots. Actually, they're all the same people.
Yeah.
The Helicopters, you know, that whole bunch. So we're going to do a thing with them. And then we will end the year doing a little swing through Italy. Thus will end the 50th anniversary, semi-centennial of the Fleshtones.
We're going to take a listen to the B-side of the anniversary single, the B-side to Folger Showboat's The Song Here Today.
Yes.
Tell us some about that. When did it get written and recorded?
Okay. Here Today, like a lot of my songs, it was in my head since the mid-80s. The guy who produced and directed The Cutting Edge, when The Cutting Edge was sort of winding down, he started a TV show called Let's Dance, which didn't take off. But In my head, I came up with a song that could be the theme song for it. But this, like I said, the show didn't happen anyway. So I had that song in my head ever since. But I didn't really have what was it about? And finally, while we were recording Float Your Showboat, it all came to me, you know, what this song was about, you know. And again, it's about, I guess it's about being around, right? You know, not disappearing. And, you know, we're here today. And you can hear it. And you can hear it today both ways, H-E-A-R or H-E-R-E, depending upon what you want to do. I think it came out okay.
I think it's actually, and it's perfect because we're talking about, you know, you're 50 years and you guys are here today. You know, the future is now, kids, is where it's
the
at.
The future is now. The future, yeah, the future is now.
Peter, thank you so much for speaking with me on our coolest conversations, man.
Manfred, you know what? I've been waiting years for this, but I realized I had to earn it.
Well, as I like the Flesh Tones, my hand is always extended.
Ah, thank you, Manfred. And you know what? I am so happy to be part of the Underground Garage. I am, I know. And I say that also because I know Stevie's always listening. But I mean it. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Well, let's take a listen to the new B-side. It's the Flesh Tones with Here Today and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Flesh Tones here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with Here Today. That's the B-side to their upcoming single, Float Your Showboat, due out September the 4th on Yep Rock Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the bands Peter Zaremba for chatting with me today. Thanks also to Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Flesh Tones celebrating 50 years together, and English singer-songwriter Graham Parker, he's celebrating the 50-year anniversary of his debut album, Howlin' Wind. The story is documented in the recent book, Graham Parker's Howlin' Wind, written by Jay Nockham. And Graham will join me next time around to tell us all about his early days, writing the songs, and recording the album. That's Graham Parker on your next Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.